The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on January 4, 2004. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all today. Well, today I want to talk about something that's not easy to talk about. The third patriarch of Zen in China wrote the Xing Qing Ming, which begins, "The great way is not difficult. There's nothing it prefers." And that's not easy to understand when it's presented that way. Though I think that that's probably fairly close to the original in the Chinese, but it's often translated as "the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." That might be easier to understand, because we understand that the great way is not so hard for you if you don't have any preferences. Of course, that whole thing about not having preferences is a little difficult as well. Also in the Xing Qing Ming, a little further down, he says that picking and choosing is the mind's worst disease. Picking and choosing is the mind's worst disease. Well, this matter of picking and choosing, this matter of intention, meaningfulness, volitional action, that sort of thing, all of these things, picking and choosing a purposeful life, whenever we begin to discuss this, it gets very, very difficult very quickly, because in Zen and in Buddhism, if we get into the deeper aspect, remember if you were here a few weeks ago, I was talking about how we can present these teachings in a relatively as simple way that makes it fairly clear. Like just when I gave the opening lines to the Xing Qing Ming, I could express it in one way that's easier to grasp than another. But the way that is more easily grasped isn't necessarily the most accurate or the most helpful or the most enlightening. And so it is with this matter of talking about preference and intention and meaning. There's ways that we can discuss this that might make it fairly understandable, but then we don't get down into the more subtle aspects of this teaching, where, for example, we begin to look at this matter of meaning that seems so important to us, but we start to look at this more carefully and we begin to realize that the more we concern ourselves with meaning, we seem to keep turning up meaninglessness. And the deeper teachings would never get us involved with meaning. The deeper teachings point directly to the experience of the moment. When we talk about this, then it sounds like the teachings become kind of heady, intellectual, difficult, murky, this sort of thing. When in fact, that's simply not the case at all. It is because we are complicated in our thinking. Our thinking is murky and difficult. And so when we encounter a teaching that is very direct, very simple, but it doesn't give us very many handles, there isn't much there we can grab onto, we think that the teaching is difficult. So this is all kind of topsy-turvy, backwards, and it creates all kinds of problems for us. Well, a couple months ago or so, I got an email from somebody who had read Buddhism Plain and Simple, liked the book. I thought the book was pretty good. But they had trouble with this discussion of how it is that for one who is awake, a Buddha, that they don't act out of will or intention. And this just seemed incomprehensible to this person. And then he gave some examples of how this didn't seem to make any sense. And of course it doesn't really make any sense, at least not at first, until we look at it a little bit more carefully, which maybe I'll get back to in a little bit. But this sort of thing does come up, and it's very important, because I tend to teach down at this more difficult end of the spectrum. I'm sorry for you, but that's where I tend to go. The reason is because this is going to be far more helpful for you. There's plenty of teaching up here where you can get stuck, where you can't move. You've grasped something, you're holding on to something, it makes sense to you, but you kind of stay there. And while you might like that, and it feels good, and you get some understanding and some intellectual grasp of it, so you feel more comfortable, but in fact, it's hard to move off of that place now. And really, where you want to go, and what I want to help you with, is to move in this direction toward actual awakening. This just simply means toward your getting your understanding not out of idea, not out of thought, not out of belief, not out of grasping something, but out of direct experience, out of a direct seeing and realization of what is taking place here. So I tend to teach a little bit more over on this end of the spectrum. But it's very, very difficult. And so then when I talk about some of these teachings, what do we talk about? Zazen is purposeless, you know, it's useless, you know, we say things like this. And then that seems kind of difficult, and we don't quite understand. Well, why would you do it? This comes up repeatedly, and I've talked about this repeatedly, and yet it is very difficult for us to really understand what is being said here. And I used to think, up until just a few days ago, maybe, that this was hard because I've often given it in speaking like this. Well, it was in my book there, too. And I did answer that fellow's question in the book. It's on page 147 is the answer. I'll have to let him know that. But what I discovered it was in the most recent Tricycle. The issue before last, I was asked the question, or they brought a question to me. I guess they asked different teachers to answer one question or another. And a person had asked, is it possible to have a meaningful practice in the absence of a living teacher? And the first thing I said was, sure. Yes, it's possible. You know, that's how I started out. But in the responses now in the most recent issue, the person who asked the question came back and said that, well, I went on talking about meaning, but I didn't answer the question. But the first thing I said was yes. Well, I said, sure, meaning yes. Yes, you can. You can have a meaningful practice in the absence of a living teacher. But I don't think that that was what the person really wanted to know. Because, as I said, we can find meaning in anything. We can find purpose in anything. The purpose, meaning, comes out of you. It doesn't come out of the teacher or the practice or the this or that. It comes out of you. Or the belief, the statement, what does it mean? You come up with that. It isn't like out there the world has meaning. It doesn't. We inject that into it. But there's a problem with this. And the more meaningful something becomes, the more we tend to move up toward this end of the spectrum where we have all kinds of graspable things. That's why things seem meaningful to us, because I can grab this, I can grab that, and it has meaning for me. And that's very well good. It makes you feel very comfortable. But we're also, if we look very carefully, we're also left with not really having a very clear understanding of just what's going on here, what human life is all about, what the situation is. In other words, deep down in our heart and mind, we're aching, we're afraid, we're obsessive, we're worried, we're driven, with no way to resolve this. Were we to move over into this area where we can't get hold of it so well, it's very difficult now to make any sense of it or to get any meaning out of it, and we find this very difficult, very uncomfortable, until we actually see. Then this whole matter of meaning, and you think about it, this is a huge problem for people, particularly in our time now, here in the 21st century, where it seems like, you know, the different things that we grasp, the different religions, the different points of view, we can grab onto one thing or another and hold them tight. But now we have a tendency to start arguing with each other and fighting, and it seems like nobody really has a handle on the truth. We all have a lot of handles on different things. But who exactly has a handle on the truth? Well, nobody. Because truth doesn't have a truth way over here and doesn't have a handle. But we can see it. But the moment you make something of it, or you try to interpret it, or you say it's like this or it's like that, it starts to become something sticky, and it starts to show up with a variety of handles, and people are grabbing onto different things. So this is a huge, huge problem for us. And furthermore, with all the stuff that we do grasp and hold on to, thinking that somehow we're finding meaning or purpose in our life, we are left with a profound sense. Oftentimes it's so deeply buried that if we have enough busyness on the surface, we don't notice it, but it's there. But we have this profound sense of ultimately it's meaningless. But meaningless, we think meaningless meaning that I have to have meaning, I have to have purpose, I have to have something to hang on to. It doesn't occur to us that actually, no, you don't. And were you free of that, you would not have a problem with this matter of either meaning or meaninglessness. So this is a very subtle thing, and a very difficult thing, and I think a very important thing for human beings. Well, last November, in the Star Tribune, I'm not quite sure what this is, a review for a book or what, but they're talking about this book that came out. I guess it's a very popular book now, and it's titled The Purpose-Driven Life, What on Earth Am I Here For? And my understanding is that it's very, very popular, and I can understand why, because if you have something here that spells out the purpose for you, that's pretty good. But of course, five purposes, yeah. There's five of them here, and fairly easily grasped, perhaps. But what they neglect to say, mainly because I don't think they're aware of it themselves, is that in taking hold of this purpose, you're the one. You're the one that says so. In the end, you're the one that has to say that that's meaningful or that's purposeful. In other words, you're the last authority, not God or the Buddha or somebody else out there or the guy that wrote this book or whatever, or the scripture. You know, you're the last word. And with that, perhaps we might notice that there's no way of getting any meaning out of anything. That opens a door and a window, if we were looking carefully, to notice actual experiences sitting right there. And we've been ignoring it all along. Well, in this book, they talk about the purpose-driven life. And here they talk about the purpose-driven church. Now, again, this is a Christian point of view, and I don't mean to knock this from the standpoint of Christianity, because everybody's like this. Everybody will come up with their purpose and their meaning or whatever, but this just lays it out so well for me to discuss that I'm going to make use of this here today. But they have these five purposes of a purpose-driven church, and it's based on the New Testament's, what they call the New Testament's Great Commandment and Great Commission. So the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. But if we notice here, this Great Commandment, once again, is considered to be God's purpose, you know, God's commandment. But again, you're the one who has to say so. See, you can't leave it to something else out there, even God. You know, you have to, in the end, you're a moral being, you're responsible. You can't lose sight of this. You have to say so. You have to say that this is meaningful. And apparently here in the book, they kind of paraphrase. They have Jesus talking here, and Jesus is saying, here's the entire Old Testament in a nutshell. I'm going to give it to you in a Cliff Notes summary, God's Word. All the law and the prophets can be condensed into two tasks. Love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. Well, these are truly wonderful, good. Though I don't know that they're so helpful when we put it in the form of a commandment. Why must it be that something, even God, if we say so, out there commands us to do something like this? To do what? Well, the first one is here to love God with all your heart. Well, sure, if we say God, no, we can begin to argue once again. But what are we talking about? Maybe what we mean is that ultimate truth, that ultimate reality in Buddhism, we say Dharma, but then we go on to point out that Dharma, this Dharma with a capital D, isn't a particular thing. Nobody owns it. It's not personified. Well, when it is personified, then we call it Buddha. But ultimate reality isn't anything that you can grasp. Can't even form ideas about it, really. But we can all see reality directly. This is the part where maybe faith steps into Buddhism. But what is it that we put faith in? Not so much that you can see reality, but just to trust and put faith in the fact that, into your own experience. Not into holding an idea or a belief or something of this sort. So here they have these five purposes. But the first one then is to love the Lord with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. Well, I think that's pretty good. To love, if we're talking about truth, being able to see reality, yes, love that. Love the Dharma. Sure, why not? Because the deep need of our heart is answered there. If were we to awaken and to just see reality, see the truth. But this is something we should be able to come to on our own without having to be commanded that you do this. Because you can't be commanded to love that. It has to come out of you somehow, that this need, this longing in the heart for the truth, for reality, has to come out of you. And that is certainly a wonderful thing. But it is also, I would say, purposeless. What is the purpose behind that? So that now you can do something. Why, anything else you might do to step away from that is kind of a step down. It is a kind of a substitute. For what was already genuine and real that was found in your life right now in this very moment, seeing reality directly, knowing that and appreciating that, loving that, having your heart right there with that. So there's no purpose behind this as such. The moment we enter purpose into it, now we have something removed. We're doing something for the sake of someone else, something else that we're being commanded to do and you should do. Now we have trouble. Now we have disturbance. Now we're opening the door to guilt and to anger and to all sorts of things. Immediately there is difficulty, there is stickiness there. We've moved into an area where things now become more graspable, and yet we've stepped away from the truth. We've stepped away from the direct realization of what is going on here. So in this strange way, by becoming kind of obsessed with purpose and meaning, we enter into something that ultimately is not very satisfying, and in the end, what does that even mean? What's the purpose in that? We're left with purposelessness and meaninglessness. Were we to learn in this very difficult way that we can't grasp, but just step into an awakening and seeing directly what is happening now in this moment, we're spared all of that. And, we're just relying on the direct experience of the moment. This other purpose here about loving your neighbor as yourself. That's great. That's wonderful. Yes, love your neighbor as yourself. If these are the great commandments, getting rid of the commandment part, rather than having to be commanded to do this, you can't be commanded to love your neighbor as yourself, for one thing. You know, because there's you and someone else outside of you is commanding you not to love your neighbor. To love your neighbor as yourself has to come out of you. It has to come out of your understanding, your realization that your neighbor is not something other than you, not something removed and apart from you. We share this life together as all beings here. We're together here. Were you to see this and were you to be able to act out of this and to not believe it as a thought or an idea, but just to see it directly, that this is really the case, that any injury inflicted upon, any injustice inflicted upon your neighbor is just as much unjust and injurious to you. Were you to see that this is the way the world operates, were you to become, when I give meditation instruction, we talk about how in the walking meditation we put our thumb inside the fist, you know? Most of you know this, I think. And it's just sort of a gesture of compassion, or a gesture of nonviolence, because here we put the thumb outside the fist. No, you might have the idea that you can hit others without doing injury to yourself. You put your thumb inside your fist, you punch somebody now, and you're going to hurt, you're going to break your thumb. But this more accurately shows how it is that we live in this world, that you're not separate from other. And any injury you might do to another is injury to yourself as well. Were we to see this and to realize this complete interconnection here, not even interconnection because there's no separation in the first place, that everything is woven in such a tight weave that we can't really pull anything out from the whole. Were we to see this and to act out of this, not because we're separate and apart and something's commanding us to do, this is how you can love your neighbor as yourself, because you don't even see yourself as something separate and apart. And this cannot be commanded. This doesn't need to be commanded. And there's no purpose behind this, because with purpose and meaning, suddenly everything's pulled apart once again, and we have the same kind of difficulty once again. So these are those first two commandments here. But then there's the great, the great commission here of living a purposeful life, this purpose-driven life. And the last three are evangelism, fellowship, and discipleship. Evangelism is to go and make disciples. Go and make disciples. Well, you don't go and make disciples, you might go and make trouble. Go and make problems for people. And then the fellowship is baptize them and teach them to obey. Well, it's really quite interesting, because I recognized when I read this that, if you go to the Bible, and here in the Gospel of St. Mark at the end, it ends with, after Christ was crucified and taken down from the cross and put into the tomb, it was a Friday before the Sabbath, he's wrapped in linen and put in the tomb, and then a large stone was placed in front of the tomb. Then the Sabbath on Saturday, Sunday morning, Mary of Magdala and Mary the mother of Jesus, they came to the tomb. Notice the stone had been rolled away. And they went inside, and they found a youth in the tomb who said that he is arisen. He's no longer here. And they ran from the tomb beside themselves with terror. And they said nothing to anybody, for they were afraid. And that's where the earliest texts end. This was the earliest account of that story. And it ends right there at that point. I mean, the Gospel of Mark is actually the earliest one written. And it ends at that point, but later on people came along and added a few other points here that were added at later times. The most recent one that was added is finally we have this passage here where Christ, in this additions, Christ was brought back. He ever came back to life and came and talked to the disciples, and then he was, apparently the two Marys did go and talk to them, but they didn't believe him. And then Christ comes and kind of rebukes them for their dullness and incredulity. But then he said to them, this is the additional part, he said, go forth into every part of the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation. Those who believe it and recite baptism find salvation. Those who do not believe it will be condemned. Faith will bring with it these miracles. Believers will cast out devils in my name and speak in strange tongues. If they handle snakes or drink any deadly poison, they will come to no harm. I've seen people speak in tongues and that, but how about drinking the deadly poison? And the sick on whom they lay their hands will recover. Well, the point I'm going on with here is actually in these first teachings that we find buried earlier in the text. Well, not buried earlier in the text, but this matter of commandments to love your neighbor as yourself and to love the Lord. Not too bad, but this matter now, it's kind of like somebody else with less insight coming along now is going to tamper with this text and add some more stuff here to give it a little bit perhaps more meaning, more purpose. This is the purpose-driven life, as it says here. And what is that? But what is your purpose? Now, to take this, I have the goods here. I've got the truth. I'm going to take this and run out and make some more disciples. And then I'm going to baptize you and all of this sort of thing and then teach you to obey these commandments. Well, I think if we were to just sit back and look at this, this is what happens when we get caught up in meaning and purpose. Because as I said earlier, this matter of meaningfulness is something that's generated by you. You've created this. And that's okay for you to work in your life. It might help you with this or that. There's just nothing wrong with that, as long as we realize that maybe in the larger picture, it doesn't have any ultimate meaning. But for you now to take your little meaning, your little package here, your little thing now, and to push this on others is a very dangerous thing to do. But this is very characteristic of a mind that is caught up in purpose and meaning and drive and all of this sort of thing. And if anything I said earlier in this talk makes any sense to you, this does take us away from any chance of really seeing directly what is going on here. That we were to get over into this place where it's very difficult. We can't get a handle now on anything. It's very difficult for us to form any ideas or beliefs or notions about this. But what are we doing at this point? We're looking at how we're living our life in each moment and recognizing what causes trouble and difficulty between people, what causes trouble and difficulty within your own heart and mind and in your interactions with others. There's no purpose behind this other than it's just what it is. It's just that, as of course anything is. And if you live in a life that is grasping and now causing trouble and difficulty with others, that's just what it is. We don't have to call that bad. We do call it things like that, bad, evil, whatever. But we think then that good then is something that I'm holding to. But of course, everybody else who's doing the same thing, they may or may not look bad to you. And we all get caught up in this whole mishmash of good and evil and finger-pointing and all the rest of this. And it goes on and on and on. This is the purpose-driven life. This is a subtle point, people. But if we were to ever break free of this, it isn't by any one of us forming the right idea, the right purpose, the right meaning, this is the truth, that what I have grasped here, you must grasp to, this is how it is. Whether we do it through coercion or whether we do it through friendliness or whether we do it through commanding or any other way, it just doesn't work. No, what it is that we need to come to is to learn that all of this stuff that we grasp and that we hold to is delusion. We think it makes us comfortable because I've grasped this, I love that, I'm holding to this. But in the end, it causes all this pain, this human misery, that these things are only provisionally useful and helpful, but they are not truth and they must be let go of by and by. Were we to see this, to have faith in that, to trust that, to have faith and trust in the experience of this moment, what is actually unfolding in this moment, rather than getting caught up in idea and belief and notions and opinions about what's going on here, this is how we spare ourselves the kind of human misery that we just load upon ourselves and perpetuate and teach our children and pass on generation after generation. This is very subtle, not easily grasped. That's why the mass of humanity remains caught in this way. But I'm just trying to point out to you what needs to be done here. Were you yourself, as an individual, you're to break free of this. You need to see this, to see how it is that you get caught, that you put so much of your life into what it is that you think, into what it is that you believe. And so then when we have like this question that came up in Tricycle, a very important issue there, can I have a meaningful practice without a living teacher? And I pointed out that sure you can. Yes, you can. Because we can find meaning, and we do. We find meaning in anything. You can find meaning in anything. The fact that you find meaning in it doesn't help. That's not awakening. That's you still grasping. You still needing something, you still being dependent on something else other than relying on the fact that you're already complete, whole, that enlightenment is already yours, it is right here, it's a matter of just seeing this. directly. We do this to ourselves, and it causes a great deal of suffering and pain. And then when we point out directly, we point directly to what the problem is, we think, you're not answering my question. You're not getting down to what I've asked you here. But this does answer that question. You find meaning? Sure, you can find meaning or not meaning. That's good. One way or the other, it doesn't matter. Yes, now set all that aside and look directly at what you're doing. And then in the case of the meditation, that's what I talked about. That the practice of meditation is nothing more than to come right into this moment directly. It's to go right to this end of the spectrum and to step right into. It's to learn how to do that without holding to anything. The actual meditation isn't even learning how to do that. It is just actually doing that because we just need to. But what is it that we need to do? We need to see how we are grasping. And that gets us back to what this question I got in the email a few months ago about intention. How is it that a Buddha, one who is awake, doesn't act out of intention? He used the example of I told that story of the raccoon who broke into my, ripped open the top of my little convertible there, stole some cookies. And I said, well, even the raccoon was acting with intention. But yeah, of course, yeah, he wanted to eat something, sure. But the point is, and then if you're going to drive somewhere, you must have some intention. Sure, that's fine. That's of course, you have some intention to go somewhere. That's okay. But that isn't where our problem comes from. Our problem comes from the fact that we begin to grasp in a way that is concerned for this little self here that forms this ego that keeps it separate from something else. And now it either wants to bring about certain kind of favorable ends and avoid others, or if wants to find some way to protect. All of this is to, and of course that gets caught up in meaning, gets caught up in fear, gets caught up in all kinds of other things, but none of it leads to enlightenment. In fact, we don't need to be led to enlightenment. We only need to be led to notice what it is that we're doing that keeps us from actually experiencing the enlightenment of this very moment. That is what this practice and what this teaching is constantly directing us to do. And so it's a very difficult thing. It's kind of like you get the question, but because we're so focused on our question and the purpose and intent of our question, we don't realize when someone points directly to what we need to do or at least points directly to where it is that we keep missing the point, like in the case of meditation, say, we don't get it because we're so focused and we expect some kind of an answer to this. When in fact, these kinds of questions really don't have answers and they don't need answers. All we need to do is to see what we're doing and to stop. In that article, I did point out the value of a teacher in that regard, that it's absolutely essential, and the great value that I appreciation have for my own teacher. Because I think without his help, I don't think I would have ever understood this. But he pointed it out repeatedly, over and over again. At a long time, I didn't understand. What's he thought? First of all, it wasn't even that. I was just sort of like, And then I started noticing he'd say things like this, but Zazen is useless. What's he talking about, But he was always pointing directly to, it's in this moment. It's in this moment. Come back to this. He'd also say, realize you are Buddha now. You're not going to be Buddha in the future. You're Buddha now. This enlightenment, this awakening is yours now. So if that's the case, there's no meaning in that because meaning removes you. This means something else over there. So immediately we're gone again. So this whole matter of meaning, we can drop that as an issue. What are we talking about? You're Buddha now. Enlightenment is not removed from you in any way whatsoever. Well then, if we were to take that to heart and to understand what's being said there, this sense that we have to look for meaning or to look for getting something out of this, or that's just simply what's being painted here, what's being pointed out is that this is the wrong understanding. This is acting and practicing out of the wrong understanding, that it is misguided. What is it then that we need to do? we need to notice what is taking place here. And like a Buddha, it says it is one that acts out of the whole. And as this person said, the email person said, well, how can anybody do that? You can't do, you don't know, you don't have enough details. Yeah, well, I discussed that actually on page 147. Yes, we can't keep track of all the details. So how is it that our mind could ever come out of the whole? Well, there's a way in which your own personal mind that you're acting out of can resemble the mind of the whole. And that's something that we actually can do. Well, what is that? It's called, as I discuss it in the book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, it's just observe whether or not your mind is leaning, tending towards something away from another. That we watch that. And to the extent that we become more skilled at watching that leaning mind, it begins to lean less. And in one who is awake, it's not leaning. There's still intention there, we could say, but that intention now is of a unique kind. It is an intention to simply be awake in each moment. And that might require that you intend to get a drink of water or call somebody up on the phone or whatever. But it isn't done for some personal reason. It is done for the sake of awakening and nothing more. It's done for the sake of just being in this moment in harmony, in peace with others. And nothing more than that. But out of that comes understanding. And as someone else said in that Tricycle article, or commenting on what I had to say, that this matter of, well, in fact, I think I got it right here. He said, what's wrong with having a purpose for meditation? There's nothing exactly wrong with it, it's just that you actually aren't in meditation if there is some purpose in it, because you're doing it for some other reason, and it's what it means. And if you're doing the meditation for some other reason, it means you're not here. And meditation is simply to be here. How can you be here if you're doing it for some other thing that takes you away? So it is just as simple as that. Well, then do we just sit here mindlessly? There's all kinds of things that go on where, you know, I didn't have any purpose behind my action. They weren't particularly good. Well, yeah, but if there's anything unwholesome in your activity in this moment, if you're there, you'll see that. It isn't like something unhealthy is going to go on now. It's going to come out of your activity and your thinking or your action. It won't, because you're present. The consequences of what you do, or that might follow from what you're doing in this very moment, are right there present in this moment, and you will see that if you're present in the moment. And so you cannot act in some unwholesome way if you are in fact in a state of meditation. It just simply can't be done, because to do so, you have to come out of the moment. And you are now acting out of that. Okay, well, this is all very difficult stuff. And I probably shouldn't talk about anything quite so difficult on a Sunday morning. Especially the first Sunday of the year for us, huh? But these had been things that had been kind of coming up lately in various ways. And I just wanted to speak to that. But very simply, now, then this matter of, if you find meaning in something, that's fine. You like to do this or that. That's all very well and good. I'm not saying that we should abandon that or whatever. It's just that what we do in our practice is, if you're practicing with the idea that I do this and now maybe I can awaken in the future, I need to put a little bit more time on that cushion so that I can... In that attitude, you have to be aware of it and realize that that is not what this is. Then at that point, maybe you can start to ask yourself, well, then what is exact? What was that again? What should I be doing? And it is nothing more than noticing what it is that you are doing. Noticing in this moment that grasping mind. It is when at last we finally do not grasp this understanding, this realization of this moment and what is truly taking place here. It just comes flooding in, and we cannot call that a purposeful life, a meaningful life. It is just this, and it is truly liberating. And it is what it is. And it is just that, utterly liberating. You will not be a zealot. You will not run out and try to make disciples or whatever, converts. No. You will spare the world of just at least one such person. Yeah. Which is pretty good. Okay, any questions or comments? Or arguments? Yes?
I always follow a question that's you, but I'm just wondering if you, there are any examples that come to your mind of teachings more at this end of the spectrum at which it's possible to get stuck and not realize it.
Oh, there's tons of them, yeah. can't you think of any? Any notion or idea that you have, in whether it's in Buddhist teachings or not, or in Christian teachings, any idea that you might be holding and that you have grasped, and that you think this is how it is, there's stickiness there. Now you're stuck. So these teachings are offered in a way, like I say, the more skillful teacher will actually get you way over to this end where you can start to move. Difficulty is, like I say, the further you get over here, the more difficulty you're going to have trying to get hold of what's being said. But anything that's being put out there has Velcro and stickiness, scotch tape all over it. So we have to be careful. But some things are more sticky than others. So you just want to avoid that. Now, you know, anything that you're holding that you think is right, this is what Buddhism teaches. You know, the Buddha likened his teaching to a raft that we leave behind. Why would he do that? That's one of the things that really caught me about Buddhism, is that in the end we get rid of the teaching even. We don't even hang on to the teaching. I don't know of any other system that does that. You know, the teaching becomes kind of the holy word, and we put it up here, and, you know. And sometimes I've seen Buddhist teachings put up like that. No, that's some serious misunderstanding there. There's no liberation in that. So the thing is, just watch this, hang on to something that you think. Like, for example, the Buddha said that human life is dukkha. Okay, well, is that true? Who are we to grasp that and say human life is suffering? You know, when we interpret dukkha, say, as suffering. Is that true? That's one that people get stuck on. In the Diamond Sutra, we say, no suffering. We say, well, then there's no suffering? Is that true? we can't say. But it's just look in this moment you where you can't grasp it, you'll see what's going on here. What about... Well, even thoughts of, like some people think that Buddhism teaches reincarnation. Well, some forms of Buddhism do, I suppose, but actually these are folk teachings that come from earlier times. But that's pretty difficult to reconcile with the fact that we can't get hold of a self. And then some people think, well, there's another one. Some people think that Buddhism teaches that there's no self. Well, is that true? There's no self? Seems like there is. What Buddhism teaches, what the Buddha taught, was that we can't get hold of a self. So whatever it is that you do get hold of, he said, that's not it. That's not self. So the teaching is not self. That's not self. That's not self. So then what's self? Well, we can't really say. We don't find it. You know, so then we say, well, then there's no self. That's going to an extreme, the Buddha says. You see. So you see, all of this, it brings us way over here to this end where in the end we can't get hold. What is it that we're doing? We're still trying to grasp. Well, what? You see, and that's what we have to watch. That's what we have to see, that we're still grasping. And it doesn't mean that you can't grasp this or that, because a lot of this is very useful and functional and helpful. You know, you grasp the concept of driving a car and following a road map to get to such and such a place. That's all very useful and helpful. That's fine. But when it comes to this matter of awakening, of ending human suffering and confusion and folly and all the rest of it, it doesn't help at all. It perpetuates. It keeps us locked in confusion. We teach that confusion to our children and it just passes on. What is it all coming from? It's all coming from the fact that we have these incredible, wonderful minds, and they truly are wonderful, but they conceptualize the experience. And that's where we get caught. We get duped into thinking that the conceptual construct of the experience is the experience, and it is not.
Does this phenomenon that you're talking about that happens at this end of the spectrum relate to the experience of maybe there's a teaching at this end of the spectrum that points to truth, but I know just the experience of them, that becomes solidified.
Yeah. Well, the way I would see this spectrum is it goes all the way to these extremes of you get to this extreme and you can't move. So if you're talking about that end of the spectrum, but there's different degrees of this, you know, and as we move over here, finally we get into teachings where now we can start to move, but we have a very difficult time understanding what it is that we're studying here, what it is that we're grasping. But that's okay. Just stay with it. Yeah, but up on that end of the spectrum, no, I'm just... I should have reversed it. But we're in here somewhere. But you should be watching. See, if you're watching your own mind, and you should be noticing to the degree to which you're getting stuck. And what is it that we're noticing there? Well, just noticing the things that you're holding to, that you're believing in, that you're hanging on to, and you think, ah, this is it, or this is what Buddhism is, this is what Buddhism teaches, it teaches this, you know. In the end, I can't exactly tell you what Buddhism teaches. I can say liberation, or the Buddha said, what I teach is, I teach but two things, dukkha and release from dukkha. But in the end, we really can't even say that. What I'm saying by that is I've spent my entire adult life studying this, not just studying it, but actually practicing it in a very heartfelt and vigorous way for many, many years now. And all I mean by that is that I don't have any... I'm not hanging on to any ideas at all about what this is. And if that's the case, I would suggest that, not that you now drop everything you're hanging on to, your ideas about Buddhism, but, I mean, like, is Buddhism a religion? Is it not a religion? I'm not going to get into, you know, we can discuss a lot of things here regarding this. But in the end, I'm not going to say, well, yes, Buddhism is a religion or it's not a religion. And so I would just say, if you want to hear what somebody like myself who's spent a lot of time looking at this and how I would treat this, you might want to just consider why that's the case and maybe look at yourself and what it is that you're hanging on to about this and about that and maybe let it go. You can use it provisionally, but in the end, don't think that you understand Buddhism. I don't presume that I do. Yeah. Yes?
I was just going to mention that I noticed the really common way that I think it's sold almost into our culture is the Zen, the word Zen. Mm-hmm. I've noticed it's become almost a marketing tool for a certain state of mind that people think that if they get this right rock that's or garden that they can raise or something.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I think it's really interesting when you really start to notice how it's used in our culture. Mm-hmm. It's just so off, you know, that this is something, if you just buy this incense and you just buy this, buy this, then everything, you could be calm. And then somehow that Zen is calm. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. And I see it I heard it in a movie the other day. I mean, you just hear it all the time. It's like it's become an adjective. Mm-hmm. And but what exactly it means is where people get stuck.
Yeah.
That it doesn't mean anything. The way they're using it, but I think that it's really interesting in our culture because it's just, again, often when I read about Buddhism, it's like it's totally from a Christian perspective and they're trying to find all the parallels, nirvana, heaven, and all that. But Zen is even more subtle and harder to understand, so that's even more misinterpreted.
Right, and then when you get all these crazy statements by these Zen masters, too, that are totally incomprehensible and they just seem silly, you know.
What I try to do when I do that, when I see that now, is try to see, okay, what is it that they, what is it that's off here? Mm-hmm. You know, and then it helps me try to understand more how I understand it instead of saying, oh my goodness, why are they doing this? To me, it's a teaching time. Look at it, and if anybody were to ask me, I would try to explain where it's off.
Don't ask. Right, yeah. Well, most people think that they see something and they think they know either that or they're perhaps not interested, but they form an idea and then they think that's it. But were we awake, it's okay to form the idea, but then you should understand that's what that is. It's nothing more than that. You've just formed an idea now. And we can almost, well, we can assure you that it really has nothing to do with reality. It's just something we formed in our mind. Might be helpful, might be useful. But in the end, it's not it. And we should never lose sight of that. So any notions I pick up and use about Buddhism, but in the end, I can assure you, I don't hang on to them. You know, so I'm not going to get into a fist fight with anybody about Buddhism. Somebody now is accusing me of, you don't believe in reincarnation. You know, because when a new book came out, I talk about that Buddha spoke of rebirth, not reincarnation. But I never said that I didn't believe in reincarnation, meaning that I have a belief that runs counter to reincarnation. No, I don't say that. We don't have to pick it up. You just don't have to pick it up. So that's another thing we don't understand. We think that we have to pick something up. No, you don't. You know, or you can, when you do pick up things, just pick them up. They're interesting. Oh, lovely. You know, and I'll set it down again. You know, but we always think we have to make it our own. Oh, this is mine. This is my idea. But we don't need to do that. Well, I probably better end it here. Does anybody else have a burning? Yes.
I've been walking on the moon for a while.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
I maybe missed something here, but today's lesson seems to be about non-attachment to purpose.
Yeah.
How does non-attachment to purpose apply to the Bodhisattva vows, which seem to be about purpose?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Does anybody want to answer that? The Bodhisattva vows are about, well, like, for example, when we sing them here now, this is the unfortunate thing about it, we don't sing the whole thing. But it says, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. You know, well, how can we do these kinds of things? If our purpose then is to save all sentient beings from suffering, and that's what it means, but they're inexhaustible, you know, they're numberless. So how can we do this? We're applying our purpose now to something that can't even be achieved. You see, well, in a sense now, that purpose now is beginning to disperse, and that purpose isn't about us as a particular thing here now trying to straighten out that other thing over there. This vow to save all sentient beings comes in the realization that there are no beings to be saved, and that these other beings, the apparently separate selves, are not something other than what you are living out in this very moment. And so then in doing this, we are vowing to come into this moment, to be present here. This is it, coming back to awakening, coming back to reality, coming back to this truth right here in this very moment. As I said earlier, that's purposeless, because it isn't to go somewhere else and to do something else. It is just simply to be in this moment. So, in other words, in this very act of learning to come back and into this very moment already, this is the vow. This is to carry out that vow to save all beings. And I've also said at other times that the purpose or intention of a Buddha is just simply to be awake. It's the same thing. But this is a unique kind of, this is that non-leaning mind. It's a unique kind of intention. Because most of the time our intention is, well, I want to do that, I want to bring this about, I want to get that, I want to get away from that. It's that ego-driven intent. The intent of a Buddha is unique, because it's the only kind of position we can be in where there's no ego, there's no self. We're not holding to a self, let's put it that way. And what has happened to purpose then at that point is that we could say that it has been kind of filed to a single non-leaning point. Yeah. And when we find it difficult to speak of intent or intentionlessness, well, we can still say that, yes, a Buddha then still does have intent, but the intent of a Buddha is just simply to be awake and nothing more than that. Knowing full well that out of awakening, now the way you act will not be injurious to others. It will not disregard the consequences of the future and that sort of thing. All of that will be taken into account. And for us, in a very practical way, it would mean just making this place here function for all of us, that rather than looking at, well, what am I going to get out of this place, I never look at Dharma Field that way. You know, how do I want it? I never look at it that way. I always look at it from the standpoint of, you know, what will best make this place function so we can work together and practice here. I'm always thinking of it in those terms. And it's not even because I'm such a good guy or anything like that. It's just that from long experience with this, I realize that for my own personal satisfaction and happiness is best met when I just forget about how I would like Dharma Field to go, and you know, and then just go ahead and act out of what appears to me in this moment to be what would be most helpful for all of us here. So that's another kind of way of the purpose. Then once again, it's not for personal gain or self or whatever like that, but it's for the sake of all. There's understanding in it, and there's also real happiness in a very personal way. It's funny, you know, to the extent that we concern ourselves with ourselves because we want to be happy, but we make ourselves miserable. You just look at that. You know, if you forget about yourself and just engage yourself in the world in ways that create harmony and a chance for people to have a sane mind and to get along and to understand, you'll be plenty happy. Nor will you have any problem with meaninglessness or any of these things. All that stuff drops away. And we put our faith in that. We trust that. Not the idea of what I just said, but the actual doing of it out of your own heart. And in doing that, that faith, that trust is supplanted with actual knowledge and experience, rather than just hanging on to some story, a belief, or an idea about something unseen. Yeah, we don't need to resort to that. Well, I better end it. I think I've gone on long enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.